to punch him in the stomach, and they punched him in the stomach before he was ready, and actually it ended up hastening his death, which happened very quickly after that. That happened in a Montreal where he was having no trouble with running into French waiters or anything like that. You would think that he had been in Vancouver reading about how it happened. That's old Montreal. Today, when you go to Montreal, you cannot help but notice that, gosh, there's another language here that it would be nice to know. I'm going to get in trouble for this, but I will say that, however, the fact remains that if you only know French in Montreal, I think you probably sense yourself at more of a disadvantage here and there than if you only know English. If you're an English speaker and you don't know any French, well, okay, the waitress speaks French, that's interesting. But the second that you make a mistake in trying to speak French, she speaks English and she's quite comfortable. And in general, you're not going to get shushed or frowned on for using your language. It's very hard to create a situation where there is no diglossia. And this varies in different parts of Quebec, but the principle is there. Now, on the other hand, while extensive bilingualism without diglossia is rare and difficult, there are situations where there is diglossia among an elite, even if most people are not bilingual. So, for example, in Anna Karenina, very often for effect or for privacy, the characters who are Russians will break into French. And it's good French. That was actually something that happened in Tsarist Russia, where the cultivated person was given good, strong training in French. And to not know any French was to be something of a barbarian among that class. Of course, the vast, vast majority of Russians were not running around speaking French. They were speaking Russian. But the Anna Karenina people were doing this. Even in America, you can see hints of it. Right now, I'm reading John O'Hara's runaway hit of 1949, A Rage to Live. It's poised awkwardly between Potboiler and literature, which is kind of what I wanted this summer, or at least this week. And it's interesting. It's about the elite of what is supposed to be Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And every now and then it's indicated that they speak French. Not as much as the Anna Karenina people, but the idea is that if you went to school, you picked up at least some. You can make your way in a conversation. I recommend A Rage to Live, by the way, actually. It's one of those books of its time, kind of like Forever Amber a little before it, and Peyton Place afterward, that, shall we say, pushes the envelope in what is now a quaint way. It's a lot of fun to read about the people doing things that they shouldn't be doing. Anyway, so as far as diglossia goes, this is a situation which is not only about people in other parts of the world eating fruit that we can't have imported and things like that. This time, I don't want to say that it's not only about us, that it's about other people. This one is not only about other people, it's about us. And so, for example, perfect example, remember Ebonics back in late 96, 97? The media chewed that up and spat it out, and I think that what most of the public learned was that there's this colorful slang used by a certain class of people, and there was a school board that wanted to teach in that, and ha, 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 ha. And that's a cute joke, but that's not really what it was about. Rather, even what is now, because of that controversy, called Ebonics, but which used to be called Black English or African American Vernacular English, that variety is spoken by people alongside standard English. So the person who can only conduct themselves in not only the slang, but as we'll see in a later lecture, the grammatical structure and the different even basic words that you sometimes find in the very different sound system of that dialect are rare. That's a child. If you go to a supermarket and there is a black mother with a little kid who's only, you know, 2.5 feet high or however high toddlers are, I don't have one of my own yet, so I don't know. Often, the toddler clearly only speaks black English yet. But that's because he's still bouncing on that knee of his mother. He or she has not been to school yet. But in general, if you are an African American, then if you control black English, then you also control standard English. And as a result, the Ebonics controversy and black English in general reveal all of the issues about diglossia that we've seen in this lecture with Egyptian Arabic and Swiss German, etc. So, for example, black English is not usually written in some fiction, but even then, to have even the narrative parts written in black English is rare. It's thought of as a spoken variety. You might depict people speaking it, but you certainly do not, for example, write a news report in black English except for comedic purposes. Then in terms of acquisition, you don't learn black English at school. You don't need to because you learned it on your mother's knee. For a person who grows up in black English, it's standard English that they get to practice their chops on in school, because that's what's being presented there. Standardization is standard English. There is no official rule book for black English. One could be written, but nobody has particularly bothered, because generally it's thought only among a certain small class of linguists and societal activists that black English is real at all. A great many people, as many of them black as white, tend to labor under the misimpression that it's all just bad grammar. And then there's the prestige issue, which is that very often a person who speaks beautiful, what you might call ebonics, when asked, will say that they don't, and often they're quite sincere. I remember walking down the street once and watching a black boy, probably 9, and his mother, I'd put her at, say, 42, and they were having a conversation about his day in standard English, and then as time went by, she said in a very warm fashion, so wasn't nobody fighting or nothing, and then she went back into standard English. Most black people do that. I'm quite sure that if one walked up to that woman and put a sheet of paper in front of her and said, would you say wasn't nobody fighting or nothing? She would, of course, say no and probably would mean it. But part of this is because generally there's an ambivalent sense about L varieties. So what ebonics was about was diglossia in the United States. Because diglossia is not generally known as a term among people other than linguists and anthropologists, it rendered all of that more confusing than it could be. But now, you know more than you did.
Lecture 17, Dialects, the Standard as Token of the Past.
Languages change quickly. It often seems as if it's a kind of majestic process, and it doesn't happen within the blink of a lifetime, but nor is it as glacially slow as one might think looking at ancient documents in Old English and thinking about the stretch of time that's taken place between them and an issue of the New York Times. Languages tend to move along. We talked about the sound changes, and those things are not to be avoided, and they tend to leap pretty quickly across generations. Final sounds that aren't taking the accent tend to fall away. A consonant like T between two vowels will tend to become D and then the and then maybe nothing between those vowels. So atta becomes adda becomes ava becomes ah. That's just natural. That happens to languages. We talked about grammaticalization, how the word for step in French, pas, ended up meaning not. And so it went from something concrete that you could see to something grammatical that just basically directs traffic within the sentence. That sort of thing happens all the time. As language actually goes, it happens faster than you might think. And it's important to realize that when I say language as a linguist, my conception of what language is in a default sense might be different from what yours is. My sense of what a language is people way off somewhere that I probably wouldn't want to be, in a rainforest or off on some steppes or something like that. And it's a small group of people, maybe about 300 people, 3,000, 4,000 at most. And they are speaking a language which is almost never written down, an indigenous language. Now, the reason that I think of that as what language really is because until relatively recently, that is the way humanity arranged itself. We were just small clumps of hunter-gatherers blanketing the globe, rarely meeting one another. So humanity lived in these sorts of clumps. Now, it's only a latter-day development that we have nations and empires and one language spoken over vast expanses. So what language really is, what we're probably biologically programmed for, is the quote-unquote exotic little language spoken by people we've never heard of, way off somewhere where we never go. And that kind of language, that normal, natural language, changes really quickly. So, for example, in Australia, depending on how you count it, there were, before Europeans came, about 300 different languages, very different and quite different from any European language. And one of them, spoken in northern Australia, is called Ngangitiemeri. And in 1930, there were linguists who studied Ngangitiemeri. And in one sentence, they found that there was a word for track, dudu, and there was a word for poke, dum. And in a sentence that meant he poked along, tracking it along here to where it made its camp, talking about a creature, then the way the sentence went, with dudu meaning track and dum meaning poke, was dudu dum, dum dudu, kingi dingi parl. And what that meant was track poke, poke track, here he sat at camp. And so, doo-doo-dum, dum-doo-doo, track-poke, poke-track, you can have them in any order. Now, what was different when the language was looked at again in 1990 was not just that there was some new slang or that the sounds were very slightly different, but that verbs worked in a whole different way. And so, back in 1930, you could say doo-doo-dum, dum-doo-doo, and it could be either way. So, trackety-pokety-pokety-trackety. By 1990, you had to say dum-doo-doo, dum-doo-doo. And dum-doo-doo was one word. And so, dum had become a prefix before doo-doo. And so, if dum means poke and doo-doo means track, then you were saying poke-track, poke-track, dum-doo-doo, dum-doo-doo, and then kingy-dingy-paro. And so, what used to be separate words had glommed together into one word that kind of meant that you tracked in a poking fashion. So what was happening was that Ngangitiemeri was on its way to being one of those languages where they pack a whole lot more into what they think of as a word than we're used to in English or than someone who speaks Chinese is used to. And so we saw an Eskimo word in an earlier lecture that packed basically a sentence's worth of meaning into one word. Well, when you're saying doo-doo-dum, when you're saying dum-doo-doo, dum-doo-doo, so pokingly tracked, you are tending to cram lots and lots of concept into one package. And that's the line that Ngangitiemeri has been taking, not over 700 billion years, but just over 60 years. So that's how fast a language is sort of, if I may, supposed to change. However, the fact remains that English has changed much more slowly since the Middle Ages. Interesting fact. Shakespeare, if we could actually talk to him, would not be as approachable as he was in the movie Shakespeare in Love. We would find that Shakespeare talked really funny. And not formally, because from what we know, Shakespeare had an informal side as well. So we don't imagine him talking as if he were a stone bust. But Shakespeare, you know, walking around, he probably had imperfect posture. He liked liquor. He belched occasionally. As a human being, still, he would have talked really funny to us. But we could have conversed with him. And so the plays that he wrote are ones that we can more or less comprehend. But then, on the other hand, Shakespeare would have found an old English speaker from 500 years before him almost as incomprehensible as a German. Shakespeare could not have conversed remotely comfortably with an old English speaker. But then, in the 500 years since him, much less change has gone on. The reason for this is that when a language is written and standardized, and then importantly, when literacy becomes widespread, then it tends to hold that variety of the language that's been written back from changing as quickly as it should, so to speak. And that's because that written form comes to be seen as the language. It's written on the page and captured for good, and therefore it seems to take on a certain substance. And then, if there's widespread literacy, then the seduction of this version of the language that's sitting there on the page has a way of affecting the way people speak, too. So nobody talks exactly like a book on a casual level, but in a society where most people are literate, people are affected to a considerable degree by the language on the page. And this requires wrapping your head around what the meaning of writing really is. You have to imagine that most languages in the world are just spoken. And so if we, for example, say, think of the word dog, there's a part of us that thinks not only of the golden retriever, but of this sequence of letters, D-O-G. If I just say dog, you can't help thinking D-O-G. That is not a normal human process. That's something that comes along when you've been exposed to the rather curious and latterly invention of representing the stream of speech that comes through your mouth as symbols upon a piece of papyrus, later paper, and then it sits there. The natural state of language is just to fall out of your mouth and to be gone as soon as you say it. So if you are an illiterate person, a completely illiterate person, then if you say dog to them, they don't think D-O-G or whatever it is in whatever language that they speak. They think of a cute, yapping creature. They have no letters. That can be difficult for us to imagine. So language really is an oral process, and it comes out of your mouth, and it's gone, and it's not written down, because for most of the history of language, there was no writing. Writing is a very peculiar thing. But once there is writing, then you're seeing the language sitting there, and that writing looks a lot realer than language looks when you're just speaking it, because, of course, when you're speaking it, you can't see it. And once it's sitting there on the page, then it seems like it's something to be copied. So, for example, we can read presidential addresses from the late 18th century. You know, there were presidential addresses by Washington, Adams. We will never hear them because they were living in a time when there was no recording. And so what they said fell out of their mouths, but they had written it down, and there were people who were taking it down while they said it. So we can read what they said, and we can see that conversing with George Washington would be no problem whatsoever. He would have used some words in ways that we wouldn't expect, but we would not be kind of beating our ears and saying A and excusing ourselves at 10 p.m. because we are tired of making the effort of understanding him. He spoke the language that we speak. But then there's a language in the Surinamese rainforest in South America, and it's spoken actually by descendants of slaves who escaped from the coast. It's called Saramaccan. It was born as a mixture between English, Portuguese, and a lot of African languages. It's a Creole. We'll learn more about Saramaccan later. But what's interesting is that while we would have no trouble with the American English of 1789, if a Saramaccan boy today could hear the way one of the chiefs in Saramacca territory was speaking in 1789, he would have a really, really hard time, because Saramaccan is, so to speak, a real language. It has been changing rapidly the way languages really do, and all sorts of things have changed. The original word for woman in Saramaccan was mulheres, kind of like mulher from Portuguese, for those of you who know Portuguese, or mujer in Spanish. It was mulheres. Well, now the word is mujer. And so the R is gone. You've got this long E. So mojere, muye. The word for not used to be no. Today, it's a. So differences like that, because languages are always changing. And Saramaccan is basically not a written language, and so it's changed at the normal pace. So we have to remember that it's an artifice to have the language sitting there on paper, looking as if it's somehow permanent because technology has engraved it there. Usually, speech is not permanent. It's just kind of happening, and therefore, the language keeps changing very quickly. And so, this brings us back to diglossia, because diglossia often happens when there's a difference between the language as it happened to be caught, like a fly in a web, on paper, and the language as it was allowed to move along naturally, the way Ngangiti Emeri and Saramaccan did, as opposed to what happened to Standard English, which is kind of frozen in aspic, so to speak. So, for example, if you have Standard Arabic, this is a frozen variety. This is a language based very closely on Arabic as it was used in the Quran. And the Quran is a religious document of great importance, and the idea is that it should not change. The notion that it doesn't change, however, does have a certain friction with the fact that language, whether you like it or not, does change. And so on the one hand, you preserve the words of Muhammad, but on the other hand, inevitably, the way that language is being spoken in the real world over millennia is going to change, and profoundly. And so as a result, you have modern Standard Arabic, which is in its way an artificially frozen variety. If that variety hadn't happened to have been captured in great literature and important liturgical literature in particular, then it would have just changed along like all the other Arabics, like Moroccan Arabic and Egyptian Arabic and Syrian Arabic and all of the rest. So as a result, the diglossia is based on the archaic variety, archaic not just in being old, but in not having been allowed to change the way a language normally would, and then the ones that have been allowed to be normal. So the other ones got to come out and play, and modern Standard Arabic is Miss Havisham. That's my attempt at an analogy. So, for example, Standard Arabic has kathira. It's not an accident that Egyptian Arabic is kathir. If you think about it, these are the kinds of sound changes that we've seen. And so, kathira, well, if you leave off that last ah sound, then you get kathir. And then, it's kathir in Egyptian Arabic. That is a less clear version of ah. So you start with kathir, and then you get k. And the th has changed to a t. These are the sorts of changes that we've seen from Old English to Modern English. Same thing in Egyptian. The last thing we would expect is that the Quran would have kathira, and then Egyptian Arabic would have something like akathariranamu or something like that. That's not how languages change. There's this abbreviation, and then new things are built in other ways, one of them being the grammaticalization. And this is something that we can see too. We'll see that a little bit later. Or modern Standard Arabic, or the Arabic of the Quran, has case endings like Latin. And so bait is house, baitu is house in the nominative, and then baiti is of the house, say the house's paint, the baiti. And then when you use house as an object, then it's baita. So you have these case endings, baitu, baiti, baita. And that is something that is relatively challenging in the early language. Well, as you notice, those case endings are unaccented, hanging at the end, and they're vowels. That sort of thing is always in danger. It's like if your cat is walking on the stove and you turn it on and the fire burns its hairs or something like that. So you know that baitu, baiti, baita, that's in danger. And that means that in the new Arabics, those case endings don't exist anymore, because that's the sort of thing that you can imagine very well might happen as a language moves along. It's natural. Whereas preserving them, as the modern Standard Arabic language does, is, majestic though it is, innocent though it is, unnatural in the sense that it hasn't allowed the language to move through time. So in a sense like this, a standardized language, which is often an H language in terms of diglossia, is analogous in its development to a wheel turning and then somebody jamming a stick into it. Really, the wheel wants to turn, but then you jam in that stick and it holds it back. Even the Javanese example that we saw is another example of this. If you remember, there was the word, for example, now. In the high language, Samenika. In the middle language, Saniki. In the low language, Saiki. What those are in a way looking at how that word evolves naturally through time. Samenika preserves the oldest form, the old Javanese form. Then the lowest form is Saiki, which is kind of like Samenika as you would say it if you started to say it and somebody patted you on the shoulder really hard. And so instead of saying Samenika, it's like Saiki. And that is what happens to words as they move through time. One thing that happens to them is they shorten. So the middle is the intermediate. So there's Samenika, there's Saniki, there's Saiki. And so the low variety is the way the language has evolved naturally. It's kind of natural Javanese. Samenika is Javanese held back. It's antiquarian Javanese. It's not an accident that the high variety is the one that's antiquarian, and the low variety is the one that's out there flexing its muscles and trying new things. That's the general tendency. In the same way, high Javanese for rice is sekul, then in the low variety it's sega. And so the k becomes the softer g, and the o of sekul drops off. So sekul, sega. That's what you would predict. And this is something that can make it difficult to learn, even languages that we're often exposed to in school. So for example, standard French, colloquial French. One of the hardest things in French, at least the way it's generally taught in America, is that you learn this language in school, and then you go to France, and you're a moron. And a lot of the reason for that is that what you're taught in school is not the way even educated, normal people talk. Instead, it's this kind of codified, hyper-standard French, which doesn't really help you when you're trying to actually be a human being in the language. And we're not just talking about slang. That's hard enough. But eventually, you're going to learn the words for pickpocket and stand up on a date and, you know, whatever the slang term for mucus is and all that. But it's the grammar itself that is something that's quite different. So, for example, in French, you learn about the double negative that we've talked about. So you learn je ne marche pas, and the ne and the pas, which are around the marche, are the negative. And so I'm not walking. Je is I. So je ne marche pas. So ne pas. That's the negative. Now, that's weird enough in its way, but you learn it, and so you learn this ne pas. So every verb has this kind of ne pas sandwich arrangement. But the thing is, in spoken French, the ne is almost always dropped, and it really is almost always. And so really, it's je marche pas. Now, it's one of those HL things. If you walk up to a French person who's walking down the street, and you grab them by the shoulders, and you look them in the eye, and say, would you say this sentence, je marche pas. Well, then probably the person is going to say, no, no, no. But the fact is, he does say it, and you could make a tape of him, and you would find that he says it 96-97% of the time. Really, in colloquial French, there's one negative marker, and it's that pas that comes after the verb. The ne is used when you're being explicit, or when you are being highly formal, or when you're accosted by a strangely curious foreigner who wants to know whether you drop ne. That's the only time that it's used. And it's been that way since the Middle Ages. That's natural. Just like certain sounds tend to erode, if you have a small, unaccented piece of stuff in your grammar like that ne, je ne marche pas, then it's dangerous. You know that something is going to happen to it. That's like a ball teetering on the edge of a counter. If you want to know how standard French is going to look at stage B, the first thing you would think is that ne has got to go. And so you would have expected that. But that means that spoken French is developing naturally, while this written French that is foisted upon we Americans in textbooks is sitting there frozen, kind of like Miss Havisham in Great Expectations. I think I'm supposed to flag that, so I did. Another example is nous for the first person plural in French. I remember when I was being taught French badly, I was taught that for I, you, he, she, then you had je, tu, il, elle. Then you go over to the other side of the diagram and you've got we, you plural, and they. And that was supposedly nous, vous, and then il with a silent S, or elle with a silent S if you were talking about people who were not men. And so then you go to France and you're armed with this nous. And I will never forget sitting somewhere and I thought that I was ordering something. you know, and we're going to have coffee. And so I say, nous prenons du café. And, you know, that's understandable. And the person runs off and goes and gets it. Now, what I thought I was saying was, we will have some coffee. No, because that's we. But that's not really the way anybody talks. Now, of course, in the textbook, it was always said in some box down at the bottom of the page, you know, written in a different font or something, that en is kind of an alternate for nous, that you might say something like, you know, on fait la vaisselle, we're doing the dishes. Kind of slangy, kind of different, something else you might want to know, but since we stuck it down here at the bottom of the page and it's not really going to be on the test and your teacher's going to sit up there saying nous, well, we wonder if you're actually going to remember anything about en. So you go to France with your nouveau and you're using this nous. You end up sounding like a jackass because really, nous is formal. It's not nous prenons du café, it's en prend. En prend du café, en this, en that, en other things. And nous is the other thing. Really, you could be given French and never taught anything about nous. You could learn nous like you would learn the idiom for that smells like a rose or something like that. But no, you're given this nous because that's the Miss Havisham version. And so, to learn spoken French somewhere where the language is actually being used, you can be whip-snap good at this artificial French that they teach you with new and all these other things. But then you get there and you've got months before you quite wrap your head around the fact that you've really been taught almost a different language. More scientifically, you've been taught an H rather than the L that everybody speaks. So you can take a very simple sentence. That's the only thing that we don't do in the standard French that you're taught. Might be, c'est la seule chose, that's the only thing, que nous ne faisons pas, that we don't do. So, c'est la seule chose que nous ne faisons pas. That's your standard French sentence. And you cannot run around talking like that and expect to have close friends, real conversations, or date. What you really have to say in spoken French is not c'est la seule chose que nous ne faisons pas. What they would say is c'est la seule chose qu'on fait pas. There's only one negative marker and you use on like a normal person. So, the Ibanez controversy is not the only area where the sense that we do not have of what diglossia is and how normal it is, can interfere with how we perceive something. Also, in terms of language teaching, I think language teaching would benefit from having more of a sense that teaching these highly formal varieties is not really helping you talk even to thoroughly respectable and educated people, and that maybe it's the high stuff that you should learn in advanced classes. So, the last thing to mention on this subject is that the standard is not always more complex. I've been talking a lot about losses because those things are real and we need to see how natural they are to avoid certain understandable tendencies to think about decay and bastardization and the end of the world, etc. But the fact is that when languages change, as I've said, they both simplify and they complexify. And what I meant by that was human language. And so non-standard dialects, or Ls, are included in that. So there are things that your L's can lose. There are things that your unwritten speech varieties can lose, but they also gain things. So for example, Arabic, standard Arabic, modern standard Arabic, has its challenges, but there's one thing about it, well, there are several things about it, but one of the things about it that's relatively simple is that they're not really too interested in subdividing time very finely in modern standard Arabic. Basically, you've got a past and a present, and that's all you get. There's no pluperfect, you know, there's no separate future. It's really just, did it happen before or is it happening now? Now let's go have tea. And so, for example, he wrote is kataba, and then he writes is yaktubu, and what those two words have in common is the root of three consonants that we talked about once. So kataba, yaktubu. Ubu, and that's it. So none of this bric-a-brac that you get in European language. But in Egyptian Arabic as well as all of the other regional Arabics, there are these time distinctions. Ways of doing that are developing. Languages get more complex, just like a cat noses into a corner or a toddler almost puts its finger into an electric socket. And in the same way, in Saudi Arabic, you do have a future. And so agul is I tell, bagul is I will tell. So they don't happen to use a separate word like we do. It's not an ending, it's a prefix, but they have a way of actually giving the future. Whereas in modern standard Arabic, they, of course, have a sense of the future in their heads, but it's often left to context in spoken language. Or there is kan, which means used to. And so agul is I tell, kan agul is I used to tell. That's a nice nuance to have in any language. So standard languages are often more complex in certain ways. But if you really look closely at the non-standard varieties, then you often find that they are developing complexities too. Another example is China. So Mandarin has four tones. And that's actually very compact as languages of that region go in terms of their tones. Now, if one thinks that a non-standard variety is always a matter of decay, then you'd think that walk 50 miles out of Beijing and you're going to start getting three tones, two tones, you know, no tone, people who are mute, something like that, but that you're going to have this decay. Actually, when you walk 50 miles out of Beijing, chances are that the non-standard Mandarin, which, make no mistake, many Chinese people, many standard Mandarin speakers would think of as bad language, decayed language, it's a natural human tendency, as often as not, you get more tones. So you can get five, you can get six, you can get seven. So these are languages where, in terms of the tones, they are more complicated than the language of the movies and the radio and TV that's considered the best Mandarin. So the main point here is that as languages change quickly. And what often keeps us from seeing this is that the languages that we by definition are most familiar with, if we're listening to or watching this set or interested in this subject or are literate people, is generally one that's been held back in its change because it was cast onto paper and therefore sits there shining forever in a way that language was never meant to. There are people in highly undeveloped societies where there's very little writing, where you talk to them and it turns out that nobody can name all of their great-grandparents. Because if you think about it, they're probably all dead, and once they're gone and no longer relevant to modern life, why would you tabulate them? We, of course, have the baby book where we have the family tree or something that we keep in the Bible, but that's because we have this artificial thing called writing. Writing holds back language change, but ordinarily, languages and their dialects change very quickly.
Lecture 18, Dialects, Spoken Style, Written Style.
In the previous few lectures, I've been working with a general implication that languages that are only spoken are, in a way, more real than languages that are written. And that's an important lesson, and we're going to see more of that a few lectures from now. But there is another truth which is important to realize at the same time, and that is that written languages do have certain what you might call advantages over oral languages. Sometimes you're not supposed to say this too loud, like many things that are true, but a written language has a larger and richer vocabulary than a solely oral language, and in many ways it has a more elaborate kind of syntax and other ways of arranging its words to convey meaning. And that is because of technology. This advantage is a kind of artificial imposition, but that advantage is there. And so the theme is that there is a huge difference between what you can do with a language when it's on the page versus what you can do with a language when you're just using it orally. There's a big difference between spoken language and written language. It can be confusing in a highly literate society such as ours, and so we're going to look at that in this lecture and get a sense of that difference. Spoken language you could call raggedy but effective, but raggedy it is. So, for example, we're going to listen to a short clip of a fundamentalist preacher, namely Adam Clayton Powell Jr., who was a famous African-American politician and preacher. He was from Harlem. And this is him in the late 1960s, and this is one of his sermons. And we're going to hear this example of artful yet spoken language. So here it is.
Keep the faith, baby. As I walk the streets of the Harlems of the world, the black Harlems and the white Harlems, people are depressed. They are frustrated. They are downtrodden. They see no hope. They see no tomorrows. And I say to them always, keep the faith, baby. I say this because all over the world, people are not receiving God. They're not getting the assurances that once were given. Promises have been broken, and their dawn refuses to rise. They're walking in the midnights of sorrow, in the midnight of frustration, in the midnight of despair. Too long have they been promised a good life by the great white fathers. Too long have they waited in vain, black and white, poor and illiterate, for the better jobs, better housing, better education, better hospitals. Yet the conditions have not changed. Except for those who have always lived in the penthouses, for the people who live in the basements, in the cellar, their lives are still drab, ugly, have no hope. And I say to them, keep the faith, baby. Keep the faith, because God's realities always exceed man's fondest dreams. Keep faith in God, whoever your God is. Keep the faith of whatever God you believe in. Keep the faith.
So that was Adam Clayton Powell Jr. That's 1967. Now, that is stirring oratory in its way. But then on the other hand, we have to admit that the sentences are short. There's a certain amount of repetition which you would be disinclined to use on the page. And in general, this is rather simple language. And it's simple in a way that is very common when we use language with our mouths in real time, in rapid fire conversation, as opposed to putting language on the page where we have more time to reflect. Now, if we actually wrote down what Adam Clayton Powell Jr. said, we would find a rather humble, almost halting kind of passage. It wouldn't look particularly majestic if we wrote it down. And that's partly because we're used to seeing written language as something that's very artificial, beautiful though it can be. So, for example, if we look at a passage from Gibbon's classic, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, then we have language like this. And this is throughout that whole work. This is the kind of text that's used. The whole engagement lasted above 12 hours, till the gradual retreat of the Persians was changed into a disorderly flight, of which the shameful example was given by the principal leaders and the Serenus himself. They were pursued to the gates of Ctesiphon, and the conquerors might have entered the dismayed city if their general, Victor, who was dangerously wounded with an arrow, had not conjured them to desist from such a rash attempt, which must be fatal if it were not successful. Now, that's beautiful, but it's very hard to imagine anybody actually speaking that way. A single sentence stretches on and on and on. A composition teacher would love the way Gibbon wrote. But what's important is that that kind of writing is only possible because there is writing. That kind of language would not be possible if there weren't a such thing as capturing speech on the page. And this is because writing is very conscious and it's slow. And this is especially compared to speech, which we do largely without thinking, and which is very rapid. As you know, if you've ever tried to actually write down speech as it was happening, and as you know, if you've ever noticed that you have to master shorthand to be able to do that effectively, because speech goes by so quickly, particularly casually and unmonitored. So writing, as much as we're used to doing it, is a very deliberate activity where your brain is turned on in a deliberate way that it isn't when we're speaking, which is something that we are biologically programmed to do on some level. And what that means is that we could not process language that was couched in that written Gibbon style if it were aimed at us in casual conversation all day. We're not designed for it. It's difficult to imagine anyone doing it. They would drive us crazy if they did. This is the kind of language that's designed to be engaged on the page, where it's in front of us, where we can reread, where we're doing something more slow than actual speaking and listening to people speaking to us. So in the Gibbon, one of the passages was, "The gradual retreat of the Persians was changed into a disorderly flight, of which the shameful example was given by the principal leaders." That's a written construction. Nobody speaks English that way. Or if they do, one, they're really kind of putting on the dog, and two, what they're doing is aping a construction that they learned from reading written English. This is not something that, say, a toddler would do. It's not something anyone would do who was not deeply immersed in written English. This is the sort of thing that you can process if you see it on the page, but would have a hard time processing while eating chicken and burping your baby. That's not the way people talk. It would take too much processing. Or the passive, "They were pursued to the gates of Ctesiphon." We would be more likely to say, "They pursued them to the gates of Ctesiphon." "They were pursued" sounds kind of like a news report, or it sounds like something that's written. And of course, news reports are readings of written language. The passive is not used nearly as much in casual speech in English as it is in written English. Or imagine somebody saying, if their general, Victor, who was dangerously wounded with an arrow, had not conjured them. No one talks that way. You don't say, "My aunt, who lives in Atlanta, is coming tomorrow." That's a joke, really. Now, you don't laugh at it when it's written, but that particular kind of relative clause is largely a written tic. We have learned to do that as we wrote, but it doesn't have a whole lot to do with the way people speak. So, for example, "Our vacation, which promises to be fun, is coming in August." No, that's not speech. That's writing. And if you see anyone depicted speaking that way, as you often do in, say, a 7th grade or 6th grade vocabulary building book, actually, people don't talk that way. I remember I had a kind of lexicon building book, these vocabulary exercises. I think it was 7th grade, and you got words like assiduous and words that you probably don't know at that age. And the example sentences always had people saying things along the lines of, "Our vacation, which was really quite fun, came to a blah, 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 blah." And I remember always thinking, who are these people who talk this way? No one talks that way. They were putting written language into these supposed living people's mouths. So if language had existed for only 24 hours, writing would have come along at about 11:08 p.m. So that's how new writing is in terms of what language is. And as we've seen, only about 200 out of the 6,000 languages are written in a real way. So writing is an artifice. And as a result, there are regular differences between the way we talk, even as thoroughly poised, intelligent, even educated people, and the way that we write. And these are differences that are very stark and very regularly found between spoken language and written language. So, for example, in speaking, even if one has a PhD, it's been shown that you use a much more limited vocabulary than is available in written language. Now, this is partly because writing allows the preservation of words over time. Under natural conditions where there's no writing and you just talk into the air, if a word drops out of use, after just a few generations, it's gone. When no one remembers that word, there's no way of retrieving it from the air or calling upon the spirits or something like that. Once there's writing, then all the old words get kind of caught in a web and saved in an artificial way. And so, there are a people called the Lokele in the former Zaire, and they use a talking drum language. Now, what's interesting is that they've been doing this for a very long time, and as such, there are many words in what they say on the talking drums in this language that nobody remembers the meaning of. And so it's just these words that you use in these settings. It's kind of like peas, porridge, hot. You know, and you kind of, what, peas, porridge, you know, what does that mean? You could find out, but really we just learn how to say it by rote and we just deal with it. Ring around the rosy. We do something with our bodies going round and round. But what precisely is it? You can look it up. These people, however, there's you don't look it up because it is a spoken language. There's nothing to look up. They just don't know what many of those words mean because the language has bypassed the point at which the talking drum language was composed. So it's a very natural phenomenon. It's different for us. And so, for example, we know the word ruthless, and then supposedly there's also a word Ruth, and Ruth means mercy. Now, you can find that in a big dictionary, but we don't use the word, and it isn't marked as obsolete. But really, Ruth is not a word. Please show me Ruth. No one has said that for hundreds and hundreds of years. It's in the dictionary, and therefore is still supposedly a word, but that's only because we have dictionaries. Or in general, you can go through a lifetime still encountering new words. I think 6 months ago, I learned sciolism. Sciolism, S-C-I-O-L-I-S-M. A pretentious journalist dropped it into a piece, and I wanted to know what it meant. Apparently, it means superficial knowledge. So, yeah, I learned a new word. That's really not a word. That word is so rare, it is so recherché, that the only reason that it exists at all for that journalist to use and for me to stuff into my head, taking up space, is because we have the printed page. That can't happen with the locale or with any language that is not written down in a real way. So, spoken English makes use of a small subset of all of the words that are kind of on life support sitting in the dictionary. So spoken English uses more or less the number of words that an oral language would use, natural language, that is. So, for example, it's been shown that even educated Americans, say at UC Berkeley, use hedges to compensate for how hard it is to make a maximal use of the vocabulary. So one quote from one piece that analyzes this has someone saying, she was still young enough, so I just was able to put her in a sort of sling. I mean, one of those tummy packs, you know. That's the way people talk. And if you think about it, it is. So this isn't somebody standing in front of a white screen presenting the language in its Sunday best. This is somebody standing in front of a cafe, probably, you know, with a baby carriage or holding something, a bird flies by, and they're just kind of chatting along. Next time you're listening to conversation, notice that it's not like my old vocabulary textbooks. People are always hedging, cleaning things up, fragments, run-ons. That's what we do in America. That's what people do all over the world. That's what language is like. So, languages used orally tend to have thousands or, say, tens of thousands of words. But the idea of a language having hundreds of thousands of words, you can't help thinking, who knows all of those words? And indeed, no one does. Only the dictionary contains them. There's nobody who knows every word in there. Or if there is, they spent their entire life learning all those words, and it's to compensate for some sense of inadequacy they feel elsewhere in their life. For the most part, we're all too busy actually being human beings. And so, only a written language can have that many words. Then there is the issue of structure. Spoken language generally uses shorter and simpler sentences than written language. This is just normal. And so, for example, here's an oral language. Here's this Saramaccan Creole that I've mentioned before, keeping you in suspense as to what this is. But now we're going to hear some Saramaccan Creole, and this is part of a folk tale. And in the passage we're going to hear, and I'll tell you what he was saying after he says it, you notice that it's in short little sentence packets. So here it goes.
Anasi, dewa konde. No have a wamuye bidari konde nade. Rimuye apali mi wadaka. You know for the apali? No, they order the conde, the other sien or sony. Have you a big garutia we? Have you a gualio? No, the gualio, they garu kode mamuye me.
So that was a passage of our mysterious Saramak in Creole. And even if you didn't know what he said, and chances are most of you don't, you know that it was short sentences. He wasn't talking like Gibbon wrote The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. Now, what he was saying was Anansi the spider was in a village, and a woman was in the village there, and the woman bore a child one day. And when she gave birth, the other people in the village didn't want to have anything to do with her. Then she prayed to the gods fervently. Then she went to the river. And when she went to the river, the gods gave her a girl child. Da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da. So that is spoken language. And if you look at passages of people actually speaking rather than reciting a folk tale, you find the same sort of thing. And in fact, as you might intuit, when writing begins of a language, at first people are inclined to write more or less the way they talk. You don't all of a sudden start writing like Gibbon just because you've got a quill in your hand or on the Flintstones a nail and a hammer or whatever it was that they used. These written conventions take a while. It takes a while for you to realize, hey, now that I've got time to work this out on paper, I can come up with something with a kind of hypercoherence that would be impossible with the mess of real life. So, for example, a very early passage of written English comes from something by pioneering printer William Caxton, and it goes like this. This is early written English when there are not yet conventions for the writing of English. Caxton wrote, "And afterward, when I remembered myself of my simpleness and unperfectness that I had in both languages, that is to wit, in French and in English, for in France, was I never, and was born and learned my English in Kent in the Weald, where I doubt not is spoken as broad and rude English as is in any place of England, and have continued by the space of 30 years for the most part in the countries of Brabant, Flanders, Holland, and Zealand." It just goes on like that. There's no sense of written style, and it's not that he was a lout, it's that no one knew how to write yet. It's the sort of thing that you would imagine. And in a way, it reflects something that's true of us. It's the sobering reality of how we actually speak English rather than write it. So, for example, this is my rendition of transcriptions of college students in the 1970s, and they are talking the way most, if not all of us, talk at many parts of our lives. And so these are two people having a conversation. This is the 1970s. On a tree. Carbon isn't going to do much for a tree, really. Really. The only thing it can do is collect moisture, which may be good for it. In other words, in the desert, you have the carbon granules, which would absorb, collect moisture on top of them. Yeah. It doesn't help the tree, but it protects, it keeps the moisture in. Because then it just soaks up moisture. It works by, the water molecules adhere to the carbon molecules that are in the ashes. It holds it on. And the plant takes it away from there. Then the other person says, "Oh, I have an argument with you." And the other person says, "Yeah." And the other person says, "You know, you said how silly it was about my, well, it's not a theory at all, that the more pregnant you are and you see spots before your eyes, it's proven that it's the retention of the water." The other one says, "Yeah, the water's just gurgling all your eyes." Now, that's not Gibbon. And there are all these hesitations, there are outright flubs and sentences that go on and on, corrections. And yet, that is most certainly the way I experience people of all walks of life talking when there's no tape recorder and there's no reason to be trying to be obnoxiously perfect. That's just the way written English that's the way spoken English tends to sound. So, for example, you could take language like that and make it into written language, but it would be a translation. You'd have to work to do it. It would be almost like working with two different languages. So, for example, this is a passage about the purchase of a dog, and this is from Great Britain, and so there's a use of the word bitch, which is meant sincerely to refer to a female dog, so this is not profane. In Britain, the word bitch doesn't have quite the sting that it does for us, because they actually use it to refer to female dogs without laughing. So that's what's going on in this passage. So somebody says, "I had to wait. I had to wait till it was born, until it got to about 8 or 10 weeks of age. Then I bought my first dachshund, a black and tan bitch puppy, as they told me I should should have bought a bitch puppy to start off with, because if she wasn't 100% good, I could choose a top champion dog to mate her to and then produce something that was good, which would be in my own kennel prefix. And this is a Brit, so our sense that they somehow speak better than us, this is them talking exactly the way we talk. This jumping from sentence to sentence to sentence and making themselves perfectly clear, that was a perfectly articulate person, but what she did not say is what the translated written version of that could be, which could be something like, some 8 or 10 weeks after the birth saw my first acquisition of a dachshund, a black and tan bitch puppy. It seems that a bitch puppy would have been the appropriate initial purchase because of the possibility of mating an imperfect specimen with a top champion dog, the improved offspring then carrying my own kennel prefix. Nobody talks like that. That's lovely, but nobody would actually put it that way. And that's because there's this difference between spoken and written language. And it's always there. There's nothing that can be